The lights are on red. We're away.
Hello and welcome to MotoGPOD, the internet radio show about motorcycle road racing, the most fantastic sport on the planet. This is episode number 157. Today is December 12th, 2008, and I am Bob Hayes, your host, here today, as always, or at least as sort of mostly always, bringing you the very best in motorcycle road racing and all kinds of good stuff along those lines. So, all of that said, let's see. Today, December 12th, is a full moon, so watch out for that. And other than that, let's see what we got going on our show today. We've got a little bit of some news stuff that came up, news and editorial commentary and things that I want to talk about a little bit. And then we're going to do a long call with Liam Schubert. Now, this call is actually a rerun. Jules Cisek did a call with Liam way back in May, and this actually ran as a special episode of MotoGPOD, so some of you might have missed it. It was on a Tuesday and between normal Friday shows and all of that, and it was just a really sort of interesting call with Liam talking about life in the MotoGP paddock and all sorts of things about how it had affected him, and just it was really interesting, and I decided to go ahead and rerun it because, again, we had a little bit of a scheduling issue, a little bit of a train wreck. Both Jules and I are having just so much stuff going on. It's insane. And I was going to talk to you about all the stuff that's going on in my life right now, but you don't need to hear it. So let's put it down as a real, real quick version that I'm very, very busy. And I just, something's got to give, folks. And unfortunately, right now, lately, it's been a little bit of the sort of following MotoGP and preparing for the podcast and all of that sort of stuff. And Jules kind of has the same thing going on, too. So running another rerun, but this is a good one. I think you're going to like it a lot. And before that, we're going to have some commentary about some things that came down the pipe. So we've got some good stuff today. Before we get to all of that, I want to send you a big reminder. Don't forget the contest that we announced last week to win one of five of the MotoGP Matters 2009 racing calendar. Calendars. And these are some awesome calendars, folks. If you haven't checked them out, MotoGPMatters.com. There's a link over there on the left side about get your calendar. It's a great gift. And of course, also, if you're a lucky winner, we're giving away five of them. So I've gotten a lot of entries already so far. We're going to announce the winners on next week's show, which is the December 19th show. And if you have not yet entered, please do so now. I will not make you wait till the end of the show for the announcement like I did last week, because that's a very devious and evil thing. But what you got to do, all you got to do to enter, it's very, very simple, very, very straightforward. Send an email to contest156@motogpod.com. That's all you got to do. contest156@motogpod.com. And I'm even going to put a link up to that on the show notes this week, which I did not do last week in a sort of a typical evil broadcaster, podcaster kind of trickery thing to make you listen to the entire show and that sort of stuff. So contest156@motogpod.com. You could win one of five of these gorgeous calendars. Gorgeous is such a fine word for this, that David Emmett over there at MotoGP Matters and Scott Jones, a longtime friend of MotoGPOD and MotoGPMatters.com and Formula One blog, by the way, big avid photographer, and he's got some great shots. So Scott Jones put all the photography together and everything. David Emmett, I assume, did some other stuff and whatever. The calendar is, it's really an awesome calendar. And I do recommend that you take a look at that at MotoGPMatters.com. It makes an excellent Christmas gift for your motorcycle racing buddies, or perhaps those people that are sitting on the fence. Do I like motorcycle racing? Do I not like motorcycle racing? I don't really know. Once they have this calendar to look at, they'll be fans. All right. So enough commercialization and all that about those MotoGP Matters calendars, which, by the way, is not commercialization. I shouldn't say that. That was a silly joke. But it's a cool calendar, folks. And I don't know about you, but I like stuff like this. You know, this is fun. I like to get things like this. So check it out, MotoGPMatters.com, the calendar. Moving on. One thing that happened here this last week, in fact, it was on December 11th, which is Thursday, and is actually today, the day that I am recording this, is that the FIM sent out a press release a communique de presse or something along those lines for the FIM Road Racing World Championship Grand Prix replacement regulations for 250cc class as from 2011. And what's funny is that they say it's the replacement regulations for 250cc class when it's not anymore, the 250cc class. So basically, here we go, folks. This is the announcement of what's going to replace the 250cc motorcycles in the 2011 season. So we got a lot of advance notice here. These guys aren't doing the AMA thing where, hey, you know, we've got 3 months left. What the hell? Why do we need rules? So in any case, Grand Prix Commission, blah, 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 in the presence of this guy, in a meeting held yesterday in Barcelona, unanimously decided to introduce the following amendments to the Road Racing World Championship Grand Prix regulations as of 2011. And I wanted to cover a couple of things on here, but just because they're sort of interesting, and we'll get some kind of commentary going and see if they really are interesting or if I'm just confused or what. But here we go. Let's see. First of all, the engine. This is obviously the most important part in this particular case of what's going to happen in 2011. Four-stroke engines only, maximum 600cc, four cylinders maximum, no oval pistons. They must be normally aspirated with no turbocharging or supercharging. The engine speed limited to a maximum of 16,000 RPM for four cylinders, 15,500 for three cylinders, or 15,000 RPM for two cylinders, blah, blah, blah. An electronic system supplied by the organizers will be permanently attached to monitor and control engine speed. Very interesting. That means a spec ECU, by the way, if you hadn't quite read that into that. Pneumatic valve operation not permitted. Some technical stuff that I'm not 100% sure of, but inlet and exhaust valves must be of conventional type, reciprocating poppet valves. Variable valve timing or variable valve lift systems are not permitted. That one is a little alarming because that's a very, very common thing. Are these prototype motorcycles or are just building whatever we had going on in 1990 and stick it in its frame? Only wet sump type engines are permitted. Some minimum weight, blah, blah, blah. Variable length inlet tract systems are not permitted. That's alarming also. Only one throttle control valve per cylinder, blah, blah, blah. Throttle bodies, internal dynamometers. Some other stuff that's, you know, it is important, but it's a bit technical for me, so I'm not going to talk about it. It's a maximum of six gearbox speeds. Here we go. Ignition, electronics, and data logging. The data logger system will be supplied by the series organizer. Section 5.2. Only the ECU or fuel injection control units supplied by the series organizer are allowed to be fitted to the motorcycle. Electronic control units include the timing transponder, the engine RPM control, and data logger systems. No other electronic control or data logging systems will be allowed on the motorcycle. And the next paragraph I thought was a little odd, because it says the price of the ECU unit made by each engine manufacturer must be equal to or less than Japan yen 75,000, about euros 650. And so maybe I'm misreading this, but it sounds like, okay, the organizer is going to supply the ECUs, and then the price of the ECU made by each engine manufacturer must be equal to or less than. And frankly, I'm totally confused on that one, but it does. We're getting a spec ECU in the 600cc, which is the replacement of the 250cc class. Blah, blah, blah. Next thing, chassis will be a prototype. We knew that all along. The design and construction of which is free within the constraints of the FIM Grand Prix technical regulations. The frame, swing arm, fuel tank, seat, and cowling are forbidden. And this is like they Googled a translation here. All those bits are forbidden to use from a non-prototype as series production road-going motorcycle. What? But in any case, what that means is they can't use, you know, production bits. It all has to be prototype frame, swing arm, fuel tank, seat, and cowling. Some minimum weights, no carbon brake discs, blah, blah, blah. No carbon composite wheels. Number of slick tires allocated to each rider per event will be controlled which there's no numbers here, but it will be told you later. Construction materials will be limited to exclude expensive, non-conventional, and that's in quotes, materials and manufacturing methods. A list will be issued. So basically, they're dumbing that down. And this is the 250cc series. They are trying to somewhat control costs because this is the one area where we've got a lot of riders on the grid. So it can't skyrocket out of control, but still. The following components must be made from iron-based alloys: the valve springs, camshafts, crankshafts, connecting rods, piston pins, and brake discs. The engine crankcases and cylinder heads must be made from cast aluminum or aluminium, if you are in Europe, alloys. And the pistons must be made from an aluminium alloy. So that was some interesting stuff. And then general, section 9, general number of machines. The team can scrutineer only one motorcycle per rider. Number of engines, maximum of 2 complete engines per rider, is it permitted in any event. Teams will be required to register the engine serial numbers at technical control, blah, blah, blah. All of the other construction criteria are as per the FIM Grand Prix regulations, which I don't have in front of me. This is just an amendment that I'm reading from. And the engine, and this is another very telling point. This is new. The engine, excluding the exhaust, throttle bodies, and ECU, that is used in a race is available to be purchased by another competitor in the same race for a fixed price of 20,000 euros. Such purchase request must be made in writing to race direction within the protest period, that is, within 60 minutes after the official end of the race. The transaction and delivery will be completed immediately at the end of the 60-minute protest period and will be underwritten by the IRTA, the International Race Teams Association. Teams refusing to sell when presented with a valid request will be disqualified. This is a very common thing in small racing series where you have a buyout like that, and it, you know, prevents one guy from spending, you know, a fortune on his engine and another guy that can't afford it and all of that. And that's great for fairground racing. Not 100% sure about prototype racing, whether or not it's the 250 class or / 600 class, whatever you call it, or the top tier premier class. Not 100% sure that I'm real comfortable with these rules, and I am not alone in that opinion. So there we go. That was one little bit of rules news that came down the pipe this past week. I encourage you to take a look. I will put a link to this official amendment in the show notes, and take a look at them yourself, see what you think. Maybe send me an email if you'd like, bob@motogpod.com. Tell me where I'm smoking crack. Tell me where I don't understand all the electronics and motorcycle-y bits, because I don't, frankly, honestly, understand exactly what's going on. I just know that I turn the key, push start a button, and thing goes. Other than that, it says, I think, though, a somewhat alarming trend in our MotoGP series, the whole series, the 125s, 250s, and MotoGP, towards a spec racing series that's kind of a dumbed-down, let's give everybody the same motorcycle that's, you know, 20-year-old technology and see who goes fastest sort of a thing. And I'm just not 100% sure that I'm a very, very big fan of that. This piece of news actually came out last week. I could have had it in last week's show, but I was just a little bit behind the eight ball. And I'm only mentioning it so much because it ties in somewhat with some MotoGP comments that I want to make. So because this is Formula One news. But last week on December 5th, Friday, December 5th, as the news story that I'm reading is dated December 6th, Honda pulls out of Formula One racing. So you may have heard this. FormulaOneBlog.com has covered it extensively, and they also had an excellent MotoGP show last week with David Emmett and Scott Jones of MotoGP Calendar, MotoGP Matters Calendar fame, and they are on that show, FormulaOneBlog.com, and it was really, really good stuff. You got to listen to it, and they're also having their own contest over there, which, you know, I'm not trying to drive you guys away from MotoGPOD, of course, but I encourage you to listen to both shows because we both have a lot to talk about. In any case, Formula One Blog has covered this in greater depth than we have, but or that we ever will. But Honda pulls out of Formula One racing, blah, 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 blah. This is a sudden decision, folks, and that Honda team in Formula One spent an enormous amount of money, reportedly the most money of any manufacturer in the paddock, and had a miserable 2007 and 2008 season. And so Honda basically has said that they are doing a dramatic example of the financial impact that the economic downturn is having in sports, blah, blah, blah. The global economic downturn has only exacerbated an already critical situation. Problems with Formula One are spiking as the big three Detroit automakers are pleading for a financial bailout. I haven't even read this news story. I know the headlines, but this particular one I have printed here, I'm reading it for the first time, folks, as if you could not tell. In any case, that's big, big news in the Formula One world that Formula One, the team, Honda factory Formula One team, has bailed out. They're not coming back next year. It's a sudden new move within the last week, and it's kind of weird. And that kind of ties in, let's get back to motorcycle racing, with some of the stuff that I want to talk about here real quick, which some of the articles that have been showing up in the most recent issues of Cycle News, which is a weekly that we have here in the United States, an excellent magazine, covers all sorts of motorcycle stuff from road racing and dirt and drags and just everything about motorcycles, anything on two wheels, particularly involving racing, is covered in Cycle News, with the occasional, of course, sidetrack with, you know, production reviews and that sort of thing. One of the things that I like best about Cycle News is their back page editorials. And you get some good names going on in here, particularly Michael Scott, who we're going to be talking about today, because his editorial that he had in the December 10th, 2008 issue of Cycle News, which is issue number 49, is talking about tough times, history repeating itself, meaning that there's a familiar feeling to the current debate of World Superbikes versus MotoGP. It's a bit like it was 10 years ago with Mick Doohan in MotoGP and Carl Fogarty in World Supers. And the gist of this article is that it's very, very worrying times with the two series of World Superbikes and MotoGP somewhat at odds as far as, you know, who's going to be the best series, who's going to be the most watched series and all of that. I mean, right now, MotoGP, hands down, is clearly the winner. They've got the audience, they've got the track attendance, they've got the dollars, they've got the glam and glitz and coolness. But one thing they don't have that World Supers does have, and motorcycle racing fans from the 2008 season can certainly attest to this, is that MotoGP does not have close racing. MotoGP in 2008 was for the most part, at many races, largely processional. Big, big gaps between the winner and the second place and third place guys and all of that. Whereas World Supers was some close, tight racing. Let's see, quoting from the article, production series side, World Superbike is in booming health. Action on the track is often breathtaking. For example, at Monza in 2008, the second race World Superbike finish was a real thriller. Noriyuki Haga, Max Neukirchner, and Ryuichi Kiyonari crossed the finish line almost side by side. Three different manufacturers, Yamaha, Suzuki, and Honda. Haga's winning margin was 9/1000ths of a second, an eye blink. And that does happen at slipstream tracks like Monza, but this was only the fifth closest finish in World Superbike history. 9/1000ths of a second, and it was their fifth closest finish. Premier Class 500cc and MotoGP racing, and with 30 years of history to call upon, whereas World Supers has how many years have World Supers been around? Certainly 15, maybe 20, in that range. But, you know, MotoGP has more. MotoGP can only muster three finishes that within that margin. A dead heat between Barry Sheen and Giacomo Agostini at Assen in 1975, with no electronic timing way back then. And then two races at 2/1000ths of a second, Alex Crivelli over Mick Doohan at Brno in 1996, and Tony Elias over Valentino Rossi at Estoril in 2006. But granted, MotoGP by and large does not have the close finishes that World Supers have. Now, what draws the audiences, and I'm digressing from the article here, but what draws audiences is this sort of thing. So MotoGP is managed because they have the glam, the glitz, the dollars, the celebrities and all of that. You know, they've kept it on top and all that. But how long can they do that when you have races with enormous margins that we've seen over the past season or two or three? The whole thing started with the 990cc down to 800cc, which was an enormous mistake. all supposedly in the terms of safety, which has actually increased cornering speed because these bikes have to somehow one way or the other, you know, make up the lack of horsepower that they're not getting on the straightaways. And he says, as science advances, this is back to the Michael Scott's article here, Tough Times, because MotoGP bikes are restricted to 21 liters of fuel means that efficiency has become a keynote. And that means that wasteful wheel spin must be eliminated. And wheel spin is what makes racing fun to watch, and it gives the riders an extra dimension of control. Now, on the other hand, production-based superbikes are a floppy armchair. By comparison, I'm quoting here again from Michael Scott's article, great gobs of big engine horsepower, broad spectrum control tires, and plenty of fuel. The rider is not drawing his picture with a fine point pencil, but a broad brush. And since he's not dealing with polished perfection, it means the rider can make more of a difference, and the consequence is closer racing. So if you're not reading these articles in Cycle News, this is just such excellent stuff, these opinions that these guys put out. And this is all going to happen because we've had the Flamini brothers in World Supers. It now has been taken over by ISC to all intents and purposes. So we've got a new organizer for World Superbikes. We've got Dorna that's pretty much in panic mode in a lot of ways and coming out with ideas, a spec tire that we've got coming up next year. I still a very, very mixed feeling about that whole thing. I think it's a bit of a knee-jerk reaction, and it's sort of a Michael Scott says it's a Band-Aid that treats the symptom rather than the disease. And I have to agree. This is not going to fix the whole problem overall, and frankly, I don't know how to fix the problem, but I don't like to see the motorcycles dumbed down, and I don't want to see a spec series and all of that. Now, you want to see a real train wreck of a series, it's AMA here in the United States, AMA Superbikes. They had some testing at Daytona over the past week, the Daytona Tire Series. There was four factories in the American Superbike thing, whatever class, whatever that is. And it's just, I don't know, they're still up in the air on a whole host of issues of exactly what's going to be happening in an AMA. And with the whole global financial meltdown that we seem to be experiencing right now, these factories aren't willing to spend the money. Hence, Honda's pulling out of Honda is pulling out of Formula One. So what is that going to mean for motorcycles? I don't know. It's going to be coming up here within very, very few months of exactly what it will mean for the 2009 season and what it will mean for the future beyond that. As far as right now is concerned, let's talk about the most recent sales figure that shows Suzuki in the United States. Suzuki having a 50% reduction in sales between October 2007 and 2008. 50%. That's a lot of motorcycles that are not getting sold, and a lot of money that's not passing from your hands into Suzuki's hands. And that means that Suzuki has a whole lot less money to spend on their racing efforts. And the whole thing is snowballing, folks. We've got a lot of things happening at the same time. This, like I said, this global financial meltdown, all caused by some greedy bankers, and combine that with some confusion over what's exactly going to be happening in motorcycle racing as far as, you know, what are we chasing after here? Are we looking for those close finishes? Are we looking for, you know, fantastic motorcycles? I don't know. There's a lot of exciting stuff that is happening in MotoGP for next year with Ducati fielding ish motorcycles, Seth Gibber now coming back, some rider changes and all of that sort of thing that we had. Yeah, I'm looking forward to a good season, but I'm not getting a whole lot of warm fuzzies about the long-term future, especially when we talk about, like I said, the 600ccs that we were just talking about. The 600cc series is basically a piece of crap. If they keep tinkering with the MotoGP rules, it's just not going to be a good thing. You've got AMA is well on its way to becoming the NASCAR of motorcycles, and that is what's going to happen unless somebody sort of reins in that whole debacle. Whereas World Superbikes is actually probably in the strongest position of all, as far as being, you know, this is, hey, you got good racing. You've got factories that are spending money on the series. You've got new factories joining the series. You've got top names coming down, and the racing is great with, you know, close finishes and exciting races and all of that sort of thing. Now, like I said in a few shows back, World Supers for me just doesn't hold the same appeal. There's just, it's almost an undefinable, you know, why do I like MotoGP better? I don't really know. Maybe it's Valentino Rossi. But see, now the latest thing is you got Valentino Rossi talking about going back over to World Rally or Formula One or whatever it is of the week, which may or may not be involved with just keeping Valentino's name in the papers. I don't know. But we're in a bit of a state of flux right now. A somewhat uncertain situation as to the whole overall long-term future of what's going to happen with all of these different series. Now, unfortunately, I haven't been following the news well enough to know what's going on with, like, the other top-level series in the world, like British Superbike and all of these guys, but everybody is facing some of these same questions of exactly what is sort of happening. So, there we go. That's my long-winded editorial for today. Why don't we go ahead and listen to Jules' call from May of 2008. Jules talked with Liam, and I actually had a suggestion from Ted Ardia, a longtime friend of MotoGPOD. Last week, after last week's show, he said, you know, if you want to do another rerun, if you ever do another rerun, make sure you run this show with Liam. And this was another one of the candidates that I had, and I chose my Pepsi Challenge because I like that. But this call with Liam, other than being a technical train wreck, was excellent stuff. Unfortunately, Jules did have some technical issues, like I said, and that's the train wreck part. So some of the audio is a little bit difficult to listen to. I'm going to let Jules explain it a little bit in his call because I'm basically cut off the front of the episode and a little bit of the intro and just kind of sticking it in here where Jules is explaining exactly what happened on this call, why there were some technical issues and all of that. But if you can work past the technical issues, it's an outstanding call. And although I do get scolded every time I sort of apologize for technical issues, I have to. And this one is just, you know, it was. And when Ted suggested it, I was like, oh my gosh, wasn't that the episode that was just, yeah. But it's good stuff. I listened to the vast majority of it again, and it's listenable, even though it's a little muddy and all of that. And we've got what we've got. Great call with Liam, which if you haven't been reading and following up and keeping up with everything, Liam is not going to be with MotoGP next year. So Liam Schubert, our man in Spain, will no longer be our man in Spain. He's going to be our man in America. And he's got an excellent post that he's winding down. He made his announcement that this is not going to happen. There's a lot of comments. And that's on the Bay Area Writers Forum, or BARF, website. And I'll put a link to that as well in the show notes. I'm going to make myself a note to put that in the show notes. BARF link. And if you want to go up there and send a quick shout out to Liam or whatever, because he has been a friend of the podcast for 3 years. It's been super great wild ride. We really appreciate it, Liam. And we managed to live vicariously through you as you lived this dream of going to work for MotoGP. And we're very, very sad to see it end. On the other hand, you know, your life is moving on and you've got to go to the next chapter of your life and all of that sort of thing. And I understand that you have your own personal reasons for it, but whatever. Thank you very, very much for sharing it with us, Liam. We always, always enjoyed it. And we hope to have you on the show in the future in whatever capacity you do choose, as, because you've always been a good friend of MotoGPOD and a super interesting guy. So all of that said, wow, Bob's getting all kind of soppy sappy here. Why don't we go ahead and listen to Jules' call with Liam? And this was right after the China race back there in May of 2008 was when those were recorded. And here we go.
I had a call with Liam Schubert on Friday, May 9th, during which Liam had a lot to say about his life in the MotoGP circus. That I think is very interesting listening. So I hope you enjoy it. I kind of turned it into a Liam monologue. I cut most of my stupid, insignificant comments out of the call. And there were some technical issues in the beginning also. We were doing the Skype to Skype to start with. That didn't turn out so good. We had some bandwidth issues. So about a third way through the call, I called his cell phone. And finished the call that way. So the quality gets better about a third way through this call. So hang in there. And hope you enjoy it.
Hi, everyone. This is Moto Liam, and you're in for a treat today because you're listening to MotoGPOD. Today is a very special episode, and I hope you all enjoy it. This is basically this is a carbon, and it was a gift from a MotoGPOD listener, Eric, in the Bay Area. Actually, this guitar has a guitar's got a great story in that one of the things that I used to do, well, I started playing guitar because my dad always played, and he played flutes and piano and anything else he could get his hands on. He was one of these, I don't know what the word is, but he could listen to something and then repeat it. You know, so whatever instrument it was, like, he would listen to something on the radio and immediately he would call the key that it was in, and then the chord progressions. And I'm not sure if it's because he just spent so many years playing when he was younger, or whether or not he had, like, this bizarre musical gift. I still don't quite understand it. But when I was in high school, you know, I'd never picked up the guitar until, I guess, I was in 11th grade, and I broke my collarbone really badly for the second time. I think the second time. And my left side was really damaged, you know, like I felt I couldn't use my arm too well. So since I stuck home and just kind of not surfing, you know, I started playing guitar. My mom knew that I was looking for a guitar and I was playing my dad, so she found me a Spanish six-string flamenco guitar at a garage sale, the Valencia model. And, you know, it was some no-name brand. It only had four strings on it. And, you know, the neck was really wide, and I didn't know what was going on. But my dad helped me restring it, and then he drew out, you know, the basic chords for me on a piece of paper. And I just went from there. So I started playing guitar for a lot of years. Had a couple of high school bands. You know, performed in front of all the kids in my grade at a talent show. And then I continued playing on through college. You know, it was a great way for me to kind of just be with the band and meet people. And I spent a long time playing when I lived in San Francisco. But after high school, instead of going to college, I moved to San Francisco because I read the book On the Road by Jack Kerouac, and it had an effect on me in that I had to go to that city. And I fell in love with that city the first time as soon as I got there. And I spent almost a year just living by myself and playing guitar the whole time. And then at some point in my life, I stopped playing. You know, I started dating someone, and it just didn't seem like I had the time or the presence of mind to just sit there and play the way I used to. So since then, my early 20s, I haven't really played a guitar at all, or any music. You know, I've always had a keen appreciation of music. I'm always listening and looking for new music. And last year, I mentioned that, wow, you know, this job is really stressing me out like nothing I've ever experienced before. And I don't really have the same kind of release that I used to have. You know, back when I lived in California, I had a collection of bikes that I could ride. And even at my job, you know, if I went to my job, which was at the Harley dealership, chances are I was riding three or four different bikes a day. You know, from anything as short as 7 miles to 50 miles, you know, whatever I needed to put mileage-wise on those bikes, I was free to do that. So I always had, you know, intermittent breaks in my day, even. If something was bothering me, I'd just get on the road and just ride, which was perfect for me. You know, and I always listened to music while I was riding, or, you know, if I needed to listen to something on the engine, whatever, I wouldn't listen to music. But music's always been an important part of my life, and I mentioned in 2007 that I was looking for a guitar. I felt that I should be and just kind of a downtime in between the races. I thought, well, maybe I should get back into playing just as a way to kind of refocus myself. And I always noticed that when I started playing something that I really enjoyed, whether it was creating my own music, which was my main deal, like to write my own music, when I would start getting into like the groove, you know, 3 or 4 hours would go by, and I'd be playing like the same thing pretty much the entire 3 or 4 hours, you know, little variations here and there, but just really in the groove, and time flew by, and it was, you know, a good release for me. So I mentioned that. And I was looking for a guitar. I'd been to a couple stores. And then, you know, one of the listeners, one of the people out there, really nice guy named Eric in the Bay Area, said, hey, I've got this guitar that I'm not really using. Is there a way I can get it to you? And at this point, I was thinking, geez, if I ship it, then for sure Customs is going to tag it with, you got to pay X amount of money in order to get this thing out of customs. And I guess I've had trouble bringing things into Spain before, whether they're new or used. So then I put up my fingers to another friend that lives here that's originally from the Bay Area in San Carlos. And his neat story is that his father used to make camshafts for sifting and was one of the chief guys that designed racing parts for Harley Davidsons back in the 60s and 70s. So he's steeped in, or even earlier, he's steeped in flat track history. I mean, grew up around flat track, knows flat track, which is one of my favorite forms of motorsport. And I said, Joe, I got this guitar in California and I got to get it over here. What do you think I should do? And he said, my brother and my dad are coming to the Catalunya race. And I said, well, I got this guitar in the Bay Area. You know, let's connect the dots and make it happen. So this was at the really, you know, the start of my busiest time of the year, I would say, race-wise. Maybe not my busiest as far as how much work I had to do when I was at my apartment, you know, working on Ducati files and whatnot. But it was as busy as I was going to get as far as traveling, because we had 6 races in 8 weeks, which is the real meat of the season, and the kind of the part of the season where you either survive or you don't. You know, as we saw in previous years, if you get a big wreck somewhere in the races, there's no recovery time. It's also a really stressful period for me because it takes time to get a piece of spike, and it just first weeks of those 6, you're not going to have the last through the enough materials in the races, and it's just it's not really feasible to stock up on tons and tons of stuff before those races start, because it's so expensive and so much of it is outsourced. It's quite impossible. Also, from a financial standpoint, you don't know, you know, what's going to start breaking or what kind of crashes you're going to have, whether you're going to have, you know, 1 per weekend or 3 on a good weekend or 0. So it's a little stressful time. But had that race, you know, this car was hurt to me, and I've had it here in my apartment. I played it a couple times. I realized, wow, my fingers are really out of shape. A lot more strength than I remembered, and I hadn't really been started to pick it up until just last night, when I knew that there was something I needed to play, something needed to come out. And so this incredibly long lead-in with a guitar basically is a lead-in for this show. Lead-in for this, because I want to talk a little bit more about what it's like to be on the race circuit rather than just results. We can talk about the results, no problem. I always love talking about it. But I want to give people a clearer idea of what my situation's like. And I'm going to talk about other people's situations and just just what it takes to maintain the kind of balance just to stay involved with the circus, not as a rider that flies in a day later or 2 days later than the team, you know, does his job for the 3 or 4 days that he's at the circuit and then flies out and generally has the finances and the time to be able to go home, whether it's the U.S. or back to his house in Europe and train for a few days. The reality is that most of us working in the paddock don't have the wherewithal to be able to fly really far and long distances if we don't live in Europe. You know, I know people that live in Australia, and sometimes a lot of them get to go back home. But on other periods, like the upcoming races that we have, so many of them, I think it's 7 and 10 weeks, if I counted this year correctly. It's just, if you've only got a week in between two races, and you've got another two after that, it doesn't make a lot of sense to spend 2 days flying back home, to be home for 3 days, and then spend 2 days flying back. You know, it messes up your internal clock, and it's just, you know, it can be obscenely expensive. So it's pretty much for this reason, the cost and the time that I'm living out here. And I know we've talked before about the kind of emotional and spiritual toll it can take traveling so much and not having constant access to your family and your loved ones. The difference between, say, my situation and my Italian teammates is that, you know, we might fly away to a far place like China, and the hotel connection we had was either non-existent. You know, everybody kind of suffers in that situation. You're gone for a week. It's too expensive to be on the cell phone, you know, upwards of $10 per minute living in China. So you can't really connect by phone, and you can't really get connected at work. You're working. You know, that frame that we've got to get on the track. And if you don't have a good internet connection in the time at your hotel, you're pretty much without contact. And that can add to a lot of stress because you wonder, oh, what's my girlfriend doing? Or what's she's thinking, what's her boyfriend doing? And it's one of the realities of having a long-distance relationship. And in a way, working in a paddock, even if I had a girlfriend living in Barcelona with me, the amount of travel time that I have outside the house makes it substantial. And probably the most difficult part would be after the race. My difference from China is that we flew back, and I come back to my apartment and say hi to my roommates, and my teammates go home. You know, unless they're working out of the race shop in Madrid, or they have to go to the factory for debriefings and meetings. My field director and Elias is chief engineer. He's the same, and he goes to the factory after every race to do a 1 or 2 day debriefing. It's more time out of the house for him, and he's got a young, less than 1 year old baby. So I know it's difficult for him, but you know they get that recharge. They get to hug their girlfriend or their wife and see their children. And it's different because, you know, not every team is the same. You know, I would say when I started, in most of my teammates were single guys, you know, and you know, we were fairly young and fresh on the scene, you know, so we wanted to go out in every city we went to. We wanted to see what each culture and people were like. I like to watch how people interact. It's quite fascinating to see women interact in different countries. You know, there's definitely different rules and different expectations and different ideas of what's appropriate and what's not. So it's interesting from that point of view. But you know, as time goes on, you know, 07 we got a little bit more stable with our team. Everybody got a little bit more settled down. They knew what to expect as far as the races and what kind of commitment and response it would take to maintain a relationship back home, wherever that was. And so 2008, I would say the majority of my team has a girlfriend back home or has a wife or is starting a family, you know, has a young child. So there's a different, slightly more mature vibe, I would say. And it's, you know, I'm not going to lie, I'm not going to say it's easy. It's really difficult to try and maintain a long-distance relationship. I mean, it'd be one thing if I was in Barcelona 100% of the time, and I could make scheduled, you know, telephone calls via Skype or see someone every day because I was always going to be online at a certain time, but it really throws a monkey wrench just to be traveling so much and to have to tell someone that loves you, hey, I'm going to be gone for a week. I don't know if the hotel's going to have internet, or be gone for 2 weeks. And you don't know, like when we go to Phillip Island, there's definitely no internet in the house. It's quite barren in that respect. And you want the other person to be strong and understand. And it's not, you know, it is a two-way street. If it stresses them out and bothers them, it stresses me out and bothers me. So I guess the bottom line is it's pretty difficult emotionally to be far away and to always be traveling. Like that's a definite as the job. And some relationships really seem to have figured it out. You know, my data guy for Gintley, Andrea, he's been on the show before. You know, he's got a great relationship with his girlfriend. I always tease him that she's his wife. They've been going out for a lot of years. And, you know, every chance he gets, he tries to call her through Skype or with her. And they reach out to her. And on the occasions that we can't, you know, it's just one of those things. And him and her have really got a handle on it. You know, they've accepted the difference with Bob. And, you know, they're a good example for me as far as how I try to lead my relationship with my girlfriend. And my girlfriend's living in San Francisco right now. And, you know, she means everything to me. And she understands and respects that I have to be out here racing right now. You know, I don't know if it's going to be a permanent thing. And you know, we work and talk about, you know, what changes we're going to make in our lives in the future. And you know, I really feel that's healthy for me to be thinking about things like that. And it's you know, it's the life. That's the relationship side of the life in the paddock. It's relationship side's not easy. And, you know, every time I see one of the guys in the paddock, you know, one of my close friends that's married and has two kids at home, and I go, wow, you know, those people are really, they really love each other and they're in it, you know. It's kind of neat. When we get together, team together at the airport, you know, we met in Frankfurt, for instance. The entire team flew in from either Milan, Madrid, or Barcelona, and we all met in Frankfurt before we took off to China. And, you know, people will take out their cell phones and show little cell phone videos of their new baby doing something. And you know, it's like, hey, look, it's getting bigger. Oh, okay. And that's really cool to see, actually. From my situation, it takes a lot of commitment to be involved with the racing. And I wouldn't have it any other way. Okay. I need to win races. I need to start winning races and get my first one. And, you know, it's just something I need to do. And girlfriend that continually inspires me to keep right. You know, she lets me know when I'm not being as good as I can be, when I should put hard. She lets me know that I need to be everything I can be, and not just work related. That's just, you know, it's mentally and emotionally. And in a way, I would say, you know, from my observations, that a lot of the paddock that's not with a girlfriend or with a wife, you know, i.e., not with a stable home life, a lot of times I kept asking, wow, maybe this guy's been on the circuit for 10 years, but in certain ways he's really immature or less developed. And it's not so much of a judgment, but it's a realization that when you get involved with this lifestyle, if you don't make the effort to have something in your home life, you know, you end up just being kind of a boy. Like, oh, I'm a boy and I love racing, and you get out on the circuit and it's just a different place every week. And while you might gain more technical proficiency, you know, you're not really growing as a person. And, you know, I see a lot of people like that are in their late 30s, early 40s, whatever, and I just think, well, you know, how's this person growing? You know, it's not things about people, but, you know, life isn't all about work. And I'm still trying to find my way into the balance of having this crazy lifestyle with my job and also having, you know, a stable, loving relationship at home. It's a lot to think about, but you have faith that if you do your best in everything, that the results are going to come.
Let's see, where were we? I was breaking up, and yes, I wanted to touch on that too. You know, you really can't understand how frustrating and difficult it can be to be always dealing with something like Skype or to be at the mercy of bandwidth. It means never having clear video calls. It means when you're trying to communicate with your significant other, you know, it's warbling and it's cutting in and out, and it's really easy to get frustrated with your partner because you can't hear them and you can't understand what they're saying, and they don't realize that it's coming out all choppy. You know, for them, it's really frustrating when the call's just not going through, or when you get a long distance phone call and it's like, it's not anybody's fault, but it just makes it, you know, that much more difficult to have, you know, crystal clear communication, to understand, you know, the nuances and maybe the tone of the conversation. You definitely can't always get tone through a chat box, you know, through a chat window. And it can be pretty easy to spin off in one direction or another because you don't know if the person is smiling when they say it, or, you know, if you see video of them, it's too blurry to make out, you know, facial expressions. So while I would say that thanks to the computer age, it's a lot easier to deal with a long-distance relationship because there is cell phones, there are video, there is Skype. You know, it does make it easier, but there's pros and cons to it. You find yourself getting upset, or I do, when I go, you know, fuck, you know, why can't I get a clear connection? And it's not anyone's fault, except maybe I happen to live in Spain and I never, you know, nowhere in Barcelona have I ever gotten a really clear, strong connection, bandwidth-wise. You know, when I upload or download something, chances are it's 12 to 25 kilobytes per second. And that's just, you know, normal files and email. Things take forever. And it's just another piece of a difficult puzzle. And I have faith and I just keep on doing my thing. And it's important to be extra sensitive, I think, when you're in a long distance relationship. You know, whether or not your girlfriend's here in Europe and you travel for work, or whether she's in California, you know, wherever the person is. But when you're apart, it can be easy to misread things, or you don't realize, you know, what something you say or do can mean to the other person. You don't see how it affects them and there's no way to really, you know, just come home after work and greet someone with a kiss at the door and say, hey, you know, I want to talk about this because, you know, this is bothering me, and it's difficult for that reason alone. You miss out on the physical affirmation of your love, and you know, you just have to have faith that the person staring into the chat window and the little camera, you know, is giving you everything they've got and trying their best as much as you are. And sometimes it's, well, every time it's not as good as a hug. So for all you married guys or guys with girlfriends out there, normally on MotoGPod, I encourage you to get on your motorcycle and go ride. You know, like, hey, it's Sunday, go for a ride on your motorcycle and then go watch the race. But for this week's romantic episode, I'm going to encourage you all just to realize and sit back and realize, hey, you know, my love, my girlfriend, my significant other is right here, you know, right in front of me. Maybe you're listening to the show at your computer in the living room, and your SO is in the dining room or in the bedroom, but just, you know, hit the pause button and go over and give them a hug, because that's another thing you really got going for you. it's far too easy to take someone for granted. And, you know, whether or not you work in MotoGP, you know, we should all realize our blessings. So hit the pause button, go and give a hug and some snuggles and some kisses, and then you can come back and we'll start talking about manly stuff, like racing. Okay, so we're back from all our hugs and kisses. You guys are feeling, yeah, I got a woman, yeah. And now we can talk about racing. Let's see, you had some notes from the China race you wanted to talk about.
Well, I mean, after all that, it all seems so insignificant. But I did want to see what you could tell me about China, the weather situation there, the pollution. Last time we talked about China, you had some amazing stuff to say about the city. So before we get into the actual race, tell me, because this is probably the last time you're going to be there.
Yeah, China's actually a really big issue for me, and it threw me for some internal loops because it's technically where I started going to MotoGP races in 2005, and it has a lot of significance for me because, you know, it's the first foreign country I really went to as an adult, and I think as a result of that trip I took in 2005, it really expanded my perspective as far as what I was capable of doing and how I viewed the world. That trip, along with, you know, my finally buying a computer that works, which was a little 12-inch PowerBook G4, the combination of the computer opening up all these different avenues for me and making information and forums and everything else so accessible, seeing, you know, through the computer that the world, you know, was nothing more than a place with different taxes and different time zones. For me, I kind of had like my epiphany, so to speak, was in 2005, and it was all, you know, about China, about what a huge, you know, crazy, amazing country this is. You know, it is a sleeping giant. It is the rudest people you've ever seen. So many times I felt that everyone was uneducated or, you know, uncultured, and yet, you know, they can produce anything they want. I'm convinced if you dropped off a Ferrari in the middle of the street somewhere in China, that within a month, you could have an exact replica of that. You know, for the most part, it's a magnificent country with so much cultural history, and a lot of people take it for granted. But, you know, you think about, oh, okay, maybe, you know, in South or Central America, the Mayans developed a calendar. Well, the Chinese also developed calendars, and they also, you know, looked to the stars, and you know, they recorded over, you know, hundreds, thousands of years, okay, this comet comes every 64 years, or, you know, whatever. So there's a lot of there's a lot of history there, and it adds to this kind of heavy, weighty feeling. You know, you step into the country off the plane, and the first thing you see is it's just one gray sky. You know, it's so destroyed by pollution around the major cities that you never see a cloud. If you do see the sun, you can look directly at it because there's so much interference from the pollution. And I took some pictures of that, which I'll put on my website probably within a couple of days. But it's, you know, your eyes sting. When I walked around the city for a couple hours, my eyes got really irritated, and it's bad. You know, it makes for some neat sunsets, but it's really bad. And construction is ever present. You know, you can't imagine, especially living in California, you know, how many of the standard roads are being torn up and redone just so they can lay another pipe so that someone can have, you know, a flushing toilet. And this is in the city, you know, not just you know, on the outskirts. And it's such a huge difference going from the city center, where you've got tourism, you've got five-star hotels, you've got everything you need within arm's reach. You know, if you want to go to a fancy restaurant, boom, you got it. If you want to go to the IMAX theater, boom, it's right there. Museums, high-end stores, you know, luxury stores, you can buy anything you want there. And then you travel 50 minutes away and you're kind of in, I don't know how I describe it, like an industrial city. You know, there are places that just go for blocks and blocks, and all they sell is pieces to complete a house or, you know, your apartment. You know, things like door fixtures, bathroom fixtures, brackets, hinges, screws, sheet metal, you know, whatever you want to buy. It's just it seems like a mile of it, you know, in every direction. And then and you go a little bit further out, and you see the living conditions people have where, you know, they've got these old buildings. I don't know when they were put up, decades ago, and the roofs have caved in. And so they've got, you know, plastic tarps up on the roof, and they're still peeing in buckets. And, you know, you think, well, these are shanties. This is as bad as it gets. And, you know, the bizarre thing is you can be next to a fancy luxury hotel in Shanghai, and right next door, on the property right next door, they've destroyed the building, you know, just knocked it all down, and it's just a pile of rubble. And, you know, some people, the workers that, you know, they do whatever they can. They're so desperate for money. They've gone in and picked out all the bricks that are salvageable, you know, and they've chipped off all the mortar that's used to hold the bricks together in a wall and stacked up all the bricks on a hand cart. What do you call it? A rickshaw. You know, these things are everywhere, and people are still, you know, some people have cell phones and iPods and computers, and other people are still working completely by hand, you know, don't have a telephone at home, you know, maybe own two pairs of pants, it seems, and they do everything just complete manual labor. And the dichotomy is that while this country's, you know, trying to raise itself up and realize how much of a world superpower it's going to be, they have so many people that it's just the price of a human life is almost nothing, I feel. You know, someone could die in the country and nobody would blink. And it could happen in the city, people starving or just not getting the kind of health care that they need. And it doesn't seem to be an issue. And nobody really talks about this kind of thing. And it's just amazing how rich people can be and how destitute the majority can be. And you really get the full impact of this when you're walking down the street and everybody is trying to make a buck off you, you know, and you've got women with babies coming up to you and little kids trying to pick your pocket, you know, and then other guys are coming to you and the first thing they say, the only English they know how to say is, you want to buy a watch, handbag, Gucci. And they try and drag you into these converted apartments, you know, and that's a major street over there. You know, they've got several of these major shopping streets with high-end stores. You know, you could buy a high-end watch. You can buy, you know, European fashion, you know, that's not even being sold in Europe, it seems. It's it's so fresh. It's in China, and just less than a block away, you know, some guy will say, "Hey, do you want to buy this?" And it'll lead you down a dark alley with no lights and up rickety wooden stairs. And the next thing you know, you're in a room full of fake goods, and it's you know, they're just struggling so much, and it really makes me depressed. You know, my first year I was really excited. And the second time I went, I was very conscious to stay for a few days after the race, and I was lucky enough that my team coordinator at the time made it happen. I was able to stay for about a week, almost a week after the race last year, and it was a chance for me to kind of explore again at my own time frame without thinking, oh, I need to be at a team dinner or, you know, I got to get back. So I could see what I want, when I wanted, that I went to all areas of the city, and it's a massive, massive city. I think the people per capita, I think square mile has got to be huge, because I saw so many condominiums just, you know, at the bare necessities as far as what you'd need to have to house a large amount of people, and they're just crammed right up against one another, and it goes on for miles. You know, it feels like L.A. as far as the sprawl, except it's a lot more tall buildings, you know, mid-sized buildings, rather than, you know, in L.A. I would say the majority is like 2 to 4 story walk-ups and townhouses type thing. This is, you know, people are crammed in there, and, you know, people travel hundreds of miles just to try and find work in the city, because that's the only place that seems to have any commerce going on. Outside the city, you know, the racetrack's about 45 minutes away on average, and if you go past the circuit another 20 kilometers or so, there's a small village called Anting, and I'd say that's where a lot of the paddock stayed. You know, they've got a couple hotels built up just to kind of take care of the people that are involved with the racing, whether it's Formula One or MotoGP. I think most of those places, they only get business twice a year. And this isn't uncommon. You know, when you look at the racetracks we go to, they're so far out of the way. It's not like Laguna Seca, which is right next to Monterey. You look at a place like Mugello, huge history, huge racetrack, right in the valley, but there's no major kind of town around there with a lot of hotels. So in Mugello, everybody's scraping to find, you know, a rental house with a lot of different rooms so that everybody can kind of have some privacy and sleep 3 or 4 to a room and share 2 bathrooms for a whole team, like that kind of deal. So it's not uncommon to have these little far-out towns and to have the racetracks so far away. But even an hour outside of Shanghai, like where we were at, you've got these large factories. Delphi was there, for instance, has a huge factory there. And Delphi, as you know, creates all the fuel injection components for General Motors. Like, you find them in Chevys, all fuel-injected Chevys have Delphi fuel injection and components. Harley-Davidson switched to Delphi, I think, when the twin cams came out, early 2000s. So you've got these complex manufacturing facilities, and they're surrounded by rice fields and shanties. Volkswagen has a huge factory out there, and they make Volkswagens that are sold in China. And I think maybe the most popular or the most common Volkswagen you'll see in China is called a Santana. And to me, it's like a 1992 Volkswagen Fox, you know, same body. And I don't know anything else other than that, but it's, you know, it's definitely not new, the design. And so you've got such an imbalance. It's just major powers are making things there because labor is so cheap, and you know, if you spend a little bit, you can ensure the quality of the material that you're making. And you know, it's in the middle of a rice field. You're constantly driving through rice fields. You know, they're making food everywhere, and next to a lot of these little shanty houses that you'll see that look like they were built too fast and not built completely. Always piles of garbage. It's like some of the time they don't seem to have some kind of garbage pickup, so they just pick one corner of the the common area, and everybody from the housing, whether it's 10 families or 50, just kind of dumps all their garbage in one pile in the corner. Next to that, you'll have everyone's got a little plot of farmland, and they're growing their own vegetables. And it's, you know, it's really shocking for someone that doesn't come from a situation like that. And, you know, we ate at a small restaurant. I remember reading online just this past race where someone said, if the race doesn't happen in China next year, what are you going to miss? And one of the riders said, well, there's this German restaurant in Anting. Well, we always go to that German restaurant, and I don't know what the name is, but I know that the guy's name is Dieter, and he wears Coke bottle glasses, and he's kind of crazy, and he's got two kids, and they do kind of dress up like old-fashioned Germans, and they do serve Wiener Schnitzel, you know, like a variant, I guess, and, you know, we ate there several nights a week, and it was... It's strange because the people that worked there that remembered us were like, hey, you're back. You know, it's like, wow, we haven't had any customers in a year. And the new people are just kind of staring at you like you're, you know, like you're a movie star or something. Like, wow, look at all these Europeans in here. This, I'm going to write home to my family about this. Like, it's a really big deal. And, you know, it's flattering in one way, but it's unsettling in another way. And, you know, when you think about it, I find myself getting more depressed through China, and it's not like I wanted to leave immediately, because I would have liked to spend more time there. But this year, most of the paddock, it seems, flies out on Sunday night. A lot of the Euro guys on my team are always joking, I hate this place, I hate the food. And while there's a grain of truth to that, they're always like, I can't wait to get out of this place. I don't care what we have to go through. As long as I can get out of here faster, I'm good with it. And that meant, okay, we check out of the hotel on Sunday morning, throw all the bags into one of the vans that we had. And, you know, another thing about the vans, we're not legal to drive in China as foreigners. So you have to hire taxi drivers, basically, but not taxis. You know, they drive like passenger vans. Oh, the bikes and all that stuff is packed into the shipping crates, the flight containers. And they get shipped there to the airport and then get brought on a big truck and unloaded by forklift. So it's a true flyaway with no transit, you know, just like the same as Japan, going to Japan or going to Laguna Seca. There's no paddock, per se, because there's no semi-trucks, no hospitalities. It's just basically the material gets delivered to the garage that you're assigned. You unpack it. They take away the empty boxes. You work the race. And then they bring the boxes, or we actually stored all our boxes in the garages themselves because they're large enough to be able to accommodate that. And that's maybe one of the good things about the garages in China. You know, we were able to keep all our boxes there. So when the race finished on Sunday, we were kind of under a time frame, under the gun, in that the race was held an hour later than normal, 3 o'clock, it wrapped up by around 4. You know, you start your technical debriefings with the riders, and as soon as that stuff starts happening, the mechanics are draining the oil, draining the water, boiling stuff coming out of the bikes, and they're breaking down the garage. The other guys are taking apart the chrono box out on pit wall. Other guys are taking the panels down from the side of the garage. I'm boxing up my final things that go back to the factory and shutting down my computers because it's time to lend a hand, and everybody just goes into this fevered, break it down and pack it up mode, which can be, you know, which for us was about 4.5 hours that night. So we're feverishly packing the boxes and applying shipping labels to the boxes because the boxes are going directly to Le Mans. And, you know, while we're breaking all that down, everyone's like, okay, we're out of here tonight. So at 8:30, everyone was like, I need to get a shower and we got to get to the airport right now. So, at about 8:30, we were basically all finished up, and everyone ran to the little office that we were assigned. China's nice enough that we've got, you know, each team has its own office, and it's got a nice shower and a bathroom, you know, and there were 2 showers an hour. So the whole team descended upon that and found our van with all our luggage and pulled out all our suitcases and ran in there and stripped down in an office, and one by one, we all grabbed a shower as fast as we could. You know, if you were smart, you brought a towel from the hotel. Otherwise, you were stuck using one of your shirts and your own laundry to dry yourself off. I mean, it's not like it's an equipped shower. So you take a shower, and we put our standard, you know, your travel clothes on, grabbed our luggage, and hightailed it to jump in the vans. Then from the circuit, the airport's on the other side of Shanghai. So you have to get in the van, go past Shanghai, and then go further to get to the airport. And I'd say we arrived before 10 o'clock to the airport, and our flight was somewhere around midnight, or I don't remember specifically. I just knew that it was a big push because, you know, you're up at 6 or 7 in the morning, you check out of the hotel, you work all day, you pack up the garage, you take a shower, and now you're at the airport and you got to get on a flight. Then you get on the flight and it's 12 hours in the plane to get back to Frankfurt, you know, your first base in Europe. And, you know, if you have trouble sleeping, that's on you. But, you know, we pile into the flight, and for some reason, I don't know why, but, you know, was it one of these cheaper flights that doesn't have TVs in the seats, you know, just the TVs at the end of the aisle, one of the older planes, I guess. And you fly 12 hours, and with the time change, 6-hour time change to Europe, you know, we arrived at 5-something in the morning, almost 6 a.m., and then we had about an hour and a half to kill before we flew out of Frankfurt and came home. And this is actually a really good compromise for everybody that had to deal with getting to the airport the night before. You know, everyone said, oh, I can't wait. When I get home, I'm back on Monday morning. That's one extra day away from the races I have, you know, where I can relax and do my thing in Europe or go bicycling or whatever on Monday. You know, instead of getting back on Tuesday, like, you know, normally we would from a long journey. And I don't know who the heck was exercising on a Monday after we got through with that huge travel. Myself, I started working, but I think by 1 o'clock I was already in email contact with the factory that afternoon, and we were exchanging files and emails back and forth through that afternoon. Then we're going to leave on Tuesday. We're going to leave on Tuesday, arrive Tuesday night, start working on Wednesday, finish up on Sunday, check out on Monday, fly out on Monday. So we'll be home on Monday. And then we've got about a week, and we do Mugello, and then immediately come to Catalunya. And then we're going to stay and test for 2 days after the race. So that's going to be a good stretch as far as we've got a two weeks of races in a row, and then we've got 2 days of testing. So that's 16 days straight working. And then less than a week to rest. You know, if we finish up the second day test at Tuesday night, so we'll be done by midnight, you've got Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and either Monday or Tuesday you're taking off for the next two set of races, the next doubleheader. And this is one of the reasons why this time of year is so challenging. You know, it's not just a question of who's the fastest, but you got to factor in endurance. You know, and the rider doesn't want to get hurt, and, you know, it's always like, how much are you willing to put out there? You know, like as we saw in China with Lorenzo, had that fantastic high side in free practice one, and everyone was thinking, you know, the first thought was, whoa, I wonder if he's okay. And the second thought was, you know, you don't get any points for free practice one. You know, you gradually increase bit by bit. You don't go out there and try to set the world on fire in your opening laps in free practice one. So, you know, there's always a little bit of cynicism from the old timers that have been involved with the sport. And, you know, it's neat because I learn a lot of lessons from them in various ways. Let's see. Man, well, that crash looked crazy.
I wanted to ask you one thing. You know, I mean, Nicky Hayden says something about just going back to the whole China, you know, just the strangeness of that city. It seems to be captured in the facilities there because it's like one of the most incredible looking buildings around the start and finish line there.
I should point out that those beautiful upside down umbrellas that they have providing shade for all the grandstand seating, you know, was built fast and it looks great, but it snows there on occasion. And the snow went into those upside down umbrellas on the far straight of the track and broke them. And all the snow fell down and broke all the chairs underneath it and destroyed that part of the grandstand. And it's just one of those things like, what the heck? So it looks great from the outside, like a lot of things from China. China can look so beautiful from the outside, and the products can look so good from the outside, but then you get underneath the surface, and you think, well, there's no real quality here. There's no substance, which is why, you know, I don't buy Chinese electronics, for example. I remember, was it last year? I think 2007, everyone got crazy about this idea that you could buy replica iPods for 15 euros, you know, and they were the same size as an iPod Nano, and they looked like an iPod Nano, but it was just, you know, a generic MP3 player, and, you know, they were mad for it. You know, I remember seeing some mechanics from one of the teams telling other mechanics on another team, and then it became this huge thing where all of them had to finish up their work early so they could get into Shanghai, and which area was the fake seller at where you could get it for 15 instead of 16 euros, and, you know, it's like, what the heck, guys? It's Chinese electronics. Back, you know, relax. But yeah, it's back to Hayden. It's an impressive structure. It looks great on TV. But things that look great on TV don't always look great up close. And I'm sure some of the people that went to the race as spectators in the last few years can attest to that. It looks fantastic, you know, compared to other racetracks around the world. But there's really no vendors. There doesn't seem to be a lot of crowd energy. It's, you know, you're basically on your own, and most of the people watching still don't know what's going on. You know, they don't sell sport bikes that look remotely like the GP bikes for the street there. So it's, you've got this huge structure that they built, and they have no motorsports culture at all. They don't have a national or native form of racing. It doesn't seem to be particularly important. It's just a really strange deal, and I think because of the strangeness, or, you know, in part because of the strangeness, I just like China. I really like the food, and I like being able to reconnect with, you know, a culture and a group of people that's still developing. You know, they're not set in their ways. They, you know, they're eager to learn. They're eager to try new things. Like, they want to welcome the West. A lot of the people want to welcome the Western traditions and explore new things and try it a different way. You know, whereas you go to some of the places in Europe and you order a salad, a pasta, a meat dish, and a coffee, and you're going to get it in the same order every time. Everybody is. And if you ask for it, no, I want it all at the same time, I'm starving. Or I want the coffee with my dessert. You know, they look at you like you're crazy. You know, and they look at you like, we know what we're doing. We developed democracy. We've been doing it this way for 2,000 years. And you're going to get the coffee after your dessert. And you're just like, dude, I just want my coffee with my dessert. Like, that's how I do it. And, you know, meanwhile, in certain restaurants in China, you say, well, I want it all at once, and I want a beer, and I want you to put vanilla ice cream in the beer. And they're like, oh, you crazy European, like, you crazy Westerner. And they do it. You know, it's just bizarre. And, you know, it's almost like a childlike culture in the way that they're so eager and they're soaking everything up like sponges, and it's just too much growth and too fast. And you want to help, you know, and does that mean giving, you know, $5 to everybody that asks you for money? Because that's not a solution. But when you have that many people and that much bureaucracy and it's just too difficult to affect changes within 5 years or 10 years. You know, you really have to redo the everything, and that takes generations at times. You know, I mentioned this to a teammate, and when you look at the faces of the old people, and this is true of older people around the world, like they were there before we hit the moon, before cell phones, before TV, before, you know, you could fly across continents. Like, the generations that we're still able to touch and speak with are just, it's amazing the amount of changes they've seen in their lifetime. And I think, in all honesty, we're not going to see the same type of you know, astronomical growth that they have seen. In, you know, like my children, yeah, maybe we'll start flying to the moon or Mars or whatever. But really, what kind of developments and improvements can we make to the quality of human life that, you know, the older generation has seen already? So, yeah, I can't imagine how some of these old folks must feel in China, like they were there before communism. They were there during communism. They were there as the West started moving in. Now they're watching TV, and it's like karaoke music and just weird stuff on TV. They've got no background on. No, you know, there's been no consistency to the growth. It was like, boom, now you got this. And then, boom, now you got that. And they're still farming outside in the morning. You know, it's just crazy what they've experienced and how they maintain a precarious balance with, you know, their traditional values and traditional way of doing things and how the West is moving in. Amazing. So I personally wish that the race continued in China for reasons like that. I think out of all the cities that I go to and all the countries that I go to, China is the most stimulating for me in that I love seeing the changes. I love seeing the growth. I love watching how the people are becoming the China of the future. And I'm really going to miss it. From me, I think most of the people on my team are not going to miss it at all.
I remember last year you had this unbelievable post on your MotoLiam.com blog about China, mm-hmm. and it just seems like you've I don't know. I think you take something a little bit different out of this whole going around the world thing than a lot of people do. For them, it's I'm not. You know, I don't know these guys that you work with. All of them. It seems like there's some people who just treat it like a job. They love the racing, but they could do it anywhere. If it was all in Europe, they'd be fine. If it was all over the world, they'd be fine. Whatever. They just fly out there. They do their job, and then they go home.
They're only there for 5 days or 7 days. Right. Like, I'm here to do my job, and that's it. And you know, maybe at this level of racing, you want someone like that, that's just completely
focused.
Yeah, obsessed or, you know, so one track minded that that's all they think about. And whenever they go to a foreign country, they're like, oh, this food's shit, I just want Italian. Oh, this food's shit, I just want Italian. I just want Italian food so that I know I'm not going to get sick and I want to do my job at the race, and that's it. And you find a lot of that ethnocentric, Eurocentric, that's the word. You find a lot of this Eurocentric vibe from a lot of people, whether or not they're, you know, older guys in their 40s that have been on the circuit for 10 years, 15 years, or young guys like myself that have only been around for a few years. It's just, you know, everybody's different. And I think even if you found people from the United States that just travel in the U.S. in the AMA, they're like, oh, okay, every time we travel to a race in the AMA, I don't care where we're at. I just want to go to the Olive Garden, you know, for example, rather than, you know, trying Southwestern barbecue in Texas or, hot links in Louisiana or wherever the heck the AMA goes. No offense, AMA folks. I think Alabama is hot link country. No, I don't know.
So anyway, so I think I think it's a shame that we won't be going back there. And you know, for all the talk about the actual racetrack not being very interesting, we've had some great racing there. I mean, like 3 years in a row, I think we've had great racing. We had the wet race.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
That was amazing. And then we had the Casey Stoner, Valentino Rossi battle last year, and then Valentino Rossi versus Pedrosa this year. I mean, we've only had one. Even the race that Pedrosa won in 2006 was a good race.
Yeah.
So, you know.
Yeah. I really wish there was more camera coverage between 4th and 10th, but, yeah. You know, basically when you've got the two guys, Valentino and Danny, up front, and they're tooth and nail right on each other, you know, you don't want to miss something there. So, it's sincere hope
And there,
in the
future. There was a lot of camera time given to Forth and Lorenzo and to Melandri. They even showed Stoner a couple of times in his lonely third spot. So, you know, they tried. But they didn't go that much further back. You're right. They didn't go. We didn't really see Tony Elias break into the top 10, which is really good to read about, but we didn't see it.
Yeah, so that was China. We had a good result for Tony. I think everybody, you know, there was a lot of emotion in that race, and after that race was over, there was a lot of, like, congratulations, and I think a lot more emotion coming off of the team members and the rider than one would have expected. Like, yeah, it's only eighth place. I mean, we got beaten by seven people. But, you know, what other people might not realize if they only watch this one race is that we've been in the trenches from, you know, late November with these guys. That's been the team from late November. And we've been working our asses off, on and off the track, and to put our riders up front. And, you know, I'm not gonna bullshit anybody and say, oh, it was like a win, it was magical. But, you know, after getting kicked in the ass and kicked in the gut for so many months, over and over, it felt really good. Like, okay, we got an eighth place. Yeah, Suzuki had trouble, two DNFs. Yeah, Kawasaki maybe made a wrong choice with their tires, you know. And you can say, oh, it's because these people dropped out, this guy crashed, whatever. And you can apply that kind of pessimistic logic to all race results. Like, Valentino was always on the best bike and the best tires, or Nicky only won because Valentino DNF'd three times, or, you know, whatever. At the end of the day, the results get added up, and that's how the championship goes. And for us, no matter what anybody else did, the times were good for us. When I look at how far back we were from Stoner at the end of the race and how far back we were from the leader, you know, it's not like we were dropping over a second a lap. You know, we were in the hunt for some points. And
yeah, it looks like Tony almost, I mean, Tony was almost in the fight with Edwards and Hayden.
Yeah, I think had we qualified better and gotten a strong, we would have been in that group for fourth. When I study the lap times, I go, damn, you know, he was throwing out some great lap times. Good enough to be in that mix. And especially, you know, the general rule of thumb is if you are up with a group of people that are moving fast and you're close enough, chances are you're going to hang with that group. You're going to be in there with them. They're going to tow you. You're going to stay behind them. You're going to try and pass them. Like, it's infinitely more difficult, I feel, when the next guy in front of you is on the horizon. And no matter how much you keep trying to chip away at, you know, and concentrate on your lines and concentrate on doing a good lap, if that guy's always far off on the horizon, you don't really, and you never seem to be making time on him. You watch your board and it's like plus two, minus point two, plus point two, whatever. It's not the same as having a guy just a few tenths in front of you where you know, if I put together a series of good corners, I can break and get right on his ass, you know, and then I can pass him shooting out or I can pass him going in. Like, it's always easier, I feel, to be up close with somebody. And, you know, and that's generally how you see the racing going anyway. Like, you've got your first group that breaks away, and you've got your second group, which is kind of the middle mix, fifth through tenth, and then you've got your last group, which kind of spreads out even more. But generally, that's how racing goes. Everyone splits up into groups where they're all relatively the same speed, and they gradually inch each other forward, and it spreads out over time like a procession. It's the most amazing races to me are the ones where you see a guy starting at the back of the pack, or he, you know, blows the start and runs off track, and he ends up in the middle of nowhere behind everybody, and he puts his head down and he passes 10 guys. Like, the guy that passes a lot just blows me away in that kind of situation. And I don't know, those are, if I could watch a rider knife his way through an entire field, that would be great for me. And I think that's why I enjoyed Mugello of 2006 so much. You saw the first group and how many rider position changes there were, and people that were leading the first five fell back to the sixth and then managed to fight their way through, and then another guy would drop out or get in the way, or, you know, for me that was a really memorable and exciting race. I know that's my kind of racing that I like to see.
Yeah, I think Melandri did a little bit of passing this time around.
Yeah, he definitely, you know, from his grid position, he motored up past 10 people and got into fourth, and then, you know, lost it to Lorenzo towards the end of the race. But, you know, for a guy that hasn't shown himself to be exceptionally comfortable on this bike, I think, you know, something happened while he was out on the track. I don't think, you know, something mystery happened between warm-up and the race. I think he got a good start and was behind people and was just throwing it in and keeping up with them, and then realized, shit, I got to pass this guy, and boom.
Yeah,
as soon as you pass that first one, the confidence was there, and he was ready to rock and roll, and he just worked his way up past everybody.
It was good. It was really good to see you guys do well with Tony, and I'm hoping that by the time you guys get to Mugello, which I know you like that track, and it always has good racing, I'm hoping we're going to see him in even higher up.
Yeah, I have good feeling for Mugello. I think we're going to try and take another step to Le Mans, which is natural. And I think generally what we're seeing in 2008 is that everything has made a step forward. Michelin has made a huge step forward. The Japanese have made a huge step forward. Maybe Kawasaki and Suzuki stumbled in the last race, but you know they're going to be back. That's the nature. You know, we're all fighting to get up to the front, and we do the best we can. And it's what keeps the racing so good. We're not racing the same stuff every week. We don't have a stock car that's the same every single race. And maybe the only difference is when I was building the engine, I sneezed, so there was a fraction of this less clearance because, you know, my mucus got in the engine or whatever. You know, it's these bikes are constantly growing and evolving. And maybe my favorite comment from a rider about racing in this series is from Stoner last year when they said, "Casey, you know, how do you manage to do fastest laps of the race at the end of the race?" And he goes, "Well, you know, we're here learning this racetrack and learning how to go fast all weekend from the first practice on Friday, second, third, fourth. I'm still learning how to race and go fast on this racetrack through the race. So it's only natural that he would be as fast as he could be at the end of the race." You know, it was just that's kind of how I see it going for the teams also. Like, we're here, we're pushing, we're always trying to get forward. We have this obsession with speed, anything to go faster.
Well said, well said. And I think that's a great way to just end the call and wish you the best of luck in Le Mans.
Thank you. And once again, I want to give a shout out.
Go ahead.
A shout out to everybody in MotoGPOD land. Send me any suggestions to my email, which will be on the MotoGPOD site. It's liam@motoliam.com. Extra special hugs and dedication to my girlfriend, Michelle. And it's been great talking. I think I really needed to get some things out, and I don't have the opportunity to express myself like I would normally do if I was back home sitting around with my friends one night having dinner, or, you know, it's just everything so far away from me at times that, you know, in a foreign country, I couldn't talk about, you know, a fraction of what we just talked about in this last call with the average guy on the street or one of my friends here, just because I don't have the command of the language to that level. And
the context is, you know, different too.
Yeah, because we come from two foreign countries, you know, they might not understand everything that I'm putting out there. You know, I think as big and as different as the United States is, culturally, we have enough common ground that I can explain everything here on MotoGPOD with a lot of West Coast listeners, which is where I've lived in the U.S. and Hawaii. And yet people from New York City, and elsewhere in the U.S. are going to understand, and they're going to be able to feel everything that I'm saying. So it's good for me to be able to just say what's up to everybody and know that people are listening. And I don't have my China post up on my website, but this time, knowing that it was going to be the last one, I was conscious to try and take a lot of pictures and think about things, and it'll be up before I head to Le Mans.
All right, thanks, Liam.
No problem.
Ciao, buddy.
Okay.
Thank you very much, Liam, for giving us a little bit of an insight into your life in the MotoGP circus.
And that's going to do it for today's show. I'm going to make this little closing very, very quick because we're already well over an hour and a half, and that's getting into the ridiculously long stage. So I hope you enjoyed today's show. That rerun that we did there of the Liam call was really, really good stuff. If you hadn't caught it the first time around, hope you enjoyed it this time around. Don't forget the contest for one of five MotoGPMatters.com 2009 racing calendars. Send me an email to contest156@MotoGPOD.com. That's all you got to do. Send an email and we'll put your name in a hat. We're going to draw out five names out of that hat. And it's an electronic hat, by the way. I'll just use a spreadsheet, but whatever. And we'll send the lucky winners a MotoGPMatters.com 2009 racing calendar. Really, really good stuff. If you haven't checked out Formula One blog lately, the podcast that they do with Todd and Grace is just excellent stuff. And like I said last week, they had a fantastic show that was covering a lot of MotoGP stuff. They had David Emmett and Scott Jones on their show. So check them out. That's Formula, spelled out, the word Formula, the number one, blog.com. So Formula 1 blog.com. Check them out. If you have never heard the podcast, I think you'll enjoy it. They're a great team, and they do an excellent, excellent job. And next week, we will be back with something that's new, fresh, exciting, and great. Or maybe not. I don't know. And in any case, we will definitely announce the winners for our contest. So make sure you tune in next week, December 19th. And I think that's about going to do it for this week. And until then, we'll talk to you later and keep the shiny side up and the rubber side down. MotoGPOD is produced by Bob Hayes, and I am solely responsible for its content. MotoGP is a trademark of Dorner Sports SL, and the MotoGPOD podcast and MotoGPOD.com are not affiliated with Dorner Sports SL. All other trademarks are the property of their respective owners, and MotoGPOD is not affiliated with any of them.